Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we're never surprised that rent's due on the first.
But we're not happy about it.
Heads up that we'll be off next week in observance of Labor Day here in the U.S. We're also starting to prepare for FinCon, an annual conference where money and media meet. Our topic will be how to create a podcast that stands out and gets noticed.
Yes.
To learn more about and decide if you should attend, visit paybal.co/FinCon18. That's paybal.co/FinCon18. If you can't follow that verbally, it will, of course, be in the show notes.
Yes, FinCon18 on the back of that. Also, as I mentioned last week, I'm part of a pitch for a panel at South by Southwest on leveraging podcasts for career success. Part of how the panel gets selected is through popular vote, and the voting period ends on August 30th. So if you haven't already, visit pickthispanel.com, which is our custom link for the panel, brings you right to the page where you need to vote for us, and upvote the session. Again, that's pickthispanel.com. Please, vote. Good brother, I know you wrote it down as an action item last week. Have you voted, man?
I did, actually. I was wondering what the hell this HYV V note you had here. I'm like, HYV? Is this some kind of new age acronym? So have you voted, folks? If you're that was that awkward confusion I was having here trying to figure out what Rich would be building up to. And I actually...
That's how I keep it organic, yeah, man. That's how I keep it organic.
I actually do want to hit the rewind button a little bit because I don't feel like I gave it the flavor or the emphasis that it needed. Like FinCon, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like it was a game changer. It continues to be a game changer. Like if you're on the fence or you're trying to network or you're trying to get out there, like, you know, it's one of those intangible things. It's one of those conferences. Like I go to conferences. I won't say where or why, but I leave like, that was cool. You know, got out of work for a few hours, you know, but like every time I leave FinCon, I'm excited. I got a huge to-do list. I usually spend the entire year trying to work my way through the last year's to-do list. There's carryovers from the year before. Like it moves the needle. A lot of people that we have on the show, invaluable networking. So I felt like, you know, I hit the little plug, you know, I'm like, visit paypal.co/FinCon18. And I was like, I didn't feel like I gave it the emphasis that it needed. So, you know, if you're on the fence, folks, get off the fence, get off the bench, get in the game and do it through FinCon.
We will say it's not the cheapest conference to attend, but at the same time, particularly if you're someone who's in the money space, you know, you're starting a podcast, blog, video, YouTuber, whatever you want to call it, this is definitely the place to be. Great connections. And a lot of the people that you've heard on the show are people that we've met at FinCon. So again, paybal.co/FinCon18 to learn more and to also get a ticket if you want to join us and everyone else that will be there in Orlando.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I forgot to plug the city that it'll be in this year. It's funny you do say that. Now, then I'll get off this horse, this particular metaphorical horse, because the first year you invited me out, it was in San Diego. And I was like, you know, man, I'm reading these headlines, you know, $117,000 is poverty in California. Rich got me out here, tried to drop, you know, money for this conference. I hadn't planned for it. It wasn't in the budget line item. So, but you were so excited. I think you were rolling off a podcast movement where everybody was telling you that we needed to go to FinCon. And I think I was, what, there 4 hours? And I sent you a text. I was like, yo, this paid for itself. Like, the conference was 3 days, but I was already knew 4 hours in that it was worth the money. Invest in yourself, folks.
That's a great testimonial, yeah, man.
That doesn't have to just be FinCon. That just happened to be the one that I'm advocating for. So, you know, I'm just saying that you need to make those moves, whatever they may be.
Definitely. So on today's episode, it is just us kicking it, talking. And on my side, I had some news to share, a couple of updates, one pretty major that we'll get to for sure, and the other we'll get to time permitting. But first off, I paid off my car note. I ain't got no car note 2 years early, and I am officially 100% debt-free, hashtag debt-free, period. So I'm feeling pretty good about that, man. And I ain't trying to come on all braggadocio, but I think there are some things within how this happened that don't get talked about very often that I thought would be good for us to talk about on the podcast.
Yeah, I started hitting you with the air horns, but I didn't want to interrupt you. You know, drop the bomb. You know, I didn't actually have the music board. So, you know, congratulations, brother. I actually remember when we started this conversation, you were thinking about paying the car off early. I didn't. 2 years. I guess time flies when you're having fun.
I was going to run through some of the basics of how it happened and what the situation was. You know, there are little details in there that I think matter. You know, I will say this won't be one of those stories where I went and lived in the basement or anything like that. A lot of it boils down to stuff that's ultimately happened by day. So in terms of the basic details, and feel free to jump in and help me clarify whatever's necessary, good brother. This was a 6-year car note, which I know that might be frowned upon, you know, at 72 months, but I had the full intention of paying this off in 5 years. So standard time frame for paying off a note for most people, they're getting a 60-month car note, or I hope most people are doing a 60-month car note, if not one that's even less than that. So 4 years or 3 years, in which case, if you are able to do that, power to you. Knowing that I was going to pay it off earlier, or this was the goal, I always made a point to pay more than whatever the monthly payment was supposed to be, which was a big thing for me. And I've been on schedule with it, but I was listening to an episode of Popcorn Finance with Chris, and he talked about how he and his wife paid off their car note to free up that cash flow. And so for myself, I found myself saying, you know what? I do have the money to pay this off now. It would hurt, going back to Financial Samurai. It will bring me tremendous sadness to see that number go down in my bank account. But at the same time, I'm going to see my total debt go to zero, and I'm going to be able to reallocate that $350 a month to something else. So I thought about it and I kept on thinking about it. And then one day I was like, you know what? Damn it. I'm paying it off. I went into the Bank of America portal and I put in the amount. I felt the pain in my chest. I hit that button and then the debt was gone, man. And the amount of relief and already even being able to put some of that money in savings, it already feels pretty good. And it's been less than a month since I paid that off.
So it was a lump sum final payment, or did you have like some type of automated saving goals or payment goals to get that knocked out? I know you said you paid over, but like, what did the plan look like?
It ended up being a lump sum payment. So I have a few months of living expenses already saved. You know, I have money that I've gotten through work, through stock that sits in my portfolio that I try not to touch. But I realized, I'm like, all right, I'm carrying debt at this point. At this point, that debt being the car note. I have the money available to pay it off and still be in decent shape should an emergency come up. So why not just knock this out now, especially since I have these other savings goals where I'm trying to put away a year's worth of income. And it's like, yes, this is going to hurt me in the short term, but in the big picture, having this extra money back in my paycheck or back in my bank account now is going to allow me to hit some of these other goals sooner. So I basically bit the bullet and made one big lump sum payment. I would caveat this again. So if you're new to the show and you're early in your career and you're like, well, that doesn't make me feel great. We have been working for a decade.
Speak for yourself. So, I've been working 15 years, man.
Wait.
Yeah, I graduated in, I guess, 2005. Got my first job 6 months later.
Even better, man. So we've been working for 13 to 14 years. You know, there are things that we've done on the career front that have helped us get in a better position financially. And one thing that I always do mention is the importance of intentionality. And so whenever I set out to achieve a goal, whether it be financial or personal or professional, I do what's necessary to make that happen. That was the same case with credit card debt. That was the case with getting a raise, getting a new job. Once I'm determined to achieve something, I do whatever is necessary to make it happen. Because I have one of those personalities where it's almost like an addiction. It's the same thing with weight loss. So when I say, you know what, I'm gonna lose 10 pounds, I do everything in my power to lose that 10 pounds. Now, I do it in a way that's healthy, where I'm not dropping like 5 pounds a week because I'm not eating, but I start taking the steps to ensure that that's going to happen. So that's eating better. That's using apps like MyFitnessPal. That's going to the gym. And I approach financial goals the same way, where I'm like, all right, where is it that I want to be? What are the steps for me to get there? And then I put that plan in place.
I think it's difficult for people to accept or understand, especially when they're in it and or when they're going through it. But I always revisit that the plan is, it's probably the highest priority, if not the game changer, because people, I think they view it as complicated. And in some ways it is. It's so they want the solution to be equally as complicated as the situation they're in when they're living paycheck to paycheck, or when they have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt, or they have a car note that they're over or under on or underwater on a home payment. And I'm like, the plan is the first step. Arguably, the first step is that mental change. Because when a lot of people, even to this day, when I talk about the book, they say, okay, what changed? Like, something had to change. Did you get did you hit the lottery? Did you get a $50,000 raise? And I'm like, no, I went to sleep. And the next day I'm like, I'm tired. I'm sick and tired of being tired. Like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I get a lot of blank stares. People are like, liar. Like, there has to be something bigger or different. So it's really the convincing people. I could talk to people about the facts all day, which, you know, they'll gloss over and fall asleep on. But how do I convince people? And I was like, okay, you know, I would say try it for 30 days. If you want to prove me wrong, try it for 30 days, because most people either will not or they won't do it for 30 days. That will convince you. But for it to work, you have to do it for somewhere between 90 days, like, because the first 30 days is just going to prove that, you know, that's a month. So like you said, like, okay, that's 1 month without a car payment. Okay, right. Yeah, $300, that's nice. But it's that 90 days, that year and year and year after, it is those opportunity costs. Now, every month, there's something else you can do differently with that $325. I told people when I was out of debt, at one point, I was paying $1,500 a month in debt. And the next month, I could technically go out and burn $1,500 in a pile of leaves, because, you know, I was just throwing that money out the door anyway. There really wasn't no change. I, of course, did not. But until you see it, it's just this foreign concept. Like, it just doesn't make sense to you. It just doesn't seem real. It seems like a dream. I was like, you know, put that plan together, get some real solid numbers around what your financial goals and plan will look like, and then trust the process.
The other thing for me, and I've said this before on the show, is I'm one of those people that likes to see money sitting in the bank account, even if it's not working for me at the utmost. So right now, a lot of my money is sitting in an Ally savings account. And I'm like, ah, it feels great to see that there. It's good to know that if something happens, I'm secure. But at the same time, I'm still carrying debt. And the other thing that I realized, because I was thinking about my net worth, I was like, ah, I'm going to pay this off. What's going to happen to my net worth? And I'm like, it's actually going to stay the same. Because I'm going to go from having that debt to not having that debt, even though my total assets will go down. It'll be a trade-off of those numbers. And I'd rather be in the position where I have zero debt and the benefits that come with the credit score and so on. And so I'm not going to lie, I've been waiting for my credit scores to update to see what the total impact is for having paid off that car note. I've been waiting. And so it sounds like I probably have another week to go, but I'm really hoping that it puts me somewhere in the high 800s, but that is TBD. And I'll let folks know when I ultimately get that update. And I try to check a few places. I check within Credit Karma. I check my credit score through a couple of my bank accounts because it's a free service offering. So I am looking forward to seeing what the impact on that number is. And with my luck, it'll probably go up like 2 points.
So I need to get this review out there. I actually did finish the book from Liz Weston, What Your Credit Score. But yeah, she talks about your, and that's the irony. We had a listener question around this. The positive payments and activities impact your score less from a percentage basis than the negative. So your score can drop 100 points just by missing, having a late payment, for example. But if you make timely payments or you pay off that debt, it doesn't move the needle as much as your negatives. And that's because it's a predictor of how you'll manage credit. So for the lender's purposes, they're more interested in what you will do poorly than what you'll do positively. I say all that to say, I wish you the best, brother, and, you know, hope you move into the 800 club. But, you know, if you do not, or if it takes more months than you would be accustomed to if you made negative spending habits, that's one reason why.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I'm not looking to buy a new car. I'm going to ride this one out until it starts giving me problems like Altima Jones did a few years back now. But if you're not looking to make some big financial move that requires credit, then yeah, it's okay if you have to wait a few months to see that total impact. The most important thing is that number is going up, whether it's 1 point, 2 points, 3 points, 5 points, whatever it is.
I wouldn't say on the other side of the scale, because that would be 300, but on the lower side of the scale, typically from all that I've seen and my personal experience, if you're 730s pushing it, but if you're 740, you'll pretty much qualify for most of the rates that you'll see advertised. You'll get into those good rates. The rates between 740 and 850 don't change at the same percentage between when you have a 630 and a 740. So that's just something to keep in mind. Like, if you strive to hit mid to high 700s, for most people, you'll get everything that you need and more.
I notice people talk a lot about good financial habits, but nobody really talks about the role of good career decisions that set you up to make money and save more money. So do you feel the same about that? Because I feel like everything is about all of these financial habits, but what about the career moves you can make to put you in a position to achieve financial freedom?
Yes, I agree. And I think it's both from what I've seen. One, you know, everyone's trying to get the click. So it's more clickbaity to have some kind of ridiculous amount of money in the headline. And then they did some thing that doesn't make any sense in the article. So I get that. You know, we all got to get these clicks in.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
But what I think it is I'm going to say it two ways. 35 years into life, 15 years almost into the career, actually, my biggest, I would say, roadblock both for myself and where I've seen myself accelerate and others is actually two simple things. And it's, well, they're not simple because people don't do them, but they're action and decision. And people fail consistently to do both. And that's why I'm trying to literally, you know, that's why we had the calls to action theme when we were doing that in the newsletter, is people listen to the show, they'll read a book. It doesn't even have to be the show. It didn't even have to be my book. And then they'll say, that was a great read. They put it down, it collects dust, and they change nothing in their life. And I'm like, yeah. And then they say, the plan didn't work. And I'm like, you didn't do anything different. People who I see who get to that next step, they decide and act. And the quicker they close that gap, the further they seem to move. And I've been with people much smarter than myself. I've been around people who make a lot more money than me, but they haven't closed that gap between acting and decision. And so they're not in the same position, and they just sit there and they sit in this spiral, and it's interesting to watch. And we'll have this discussion, resolution or problem or whatever it may be. And then I'll be like, so what's the decision? Or there's no call to action. We just, and then we'll talk about it the next week and the next week and the next month. I'm sure you folks know individuals like this where you've probably been revisiting a conversation for the last 10 years and you're just...
Man, that's been me saying I'm going to leave corporate America. I've been talking about that for a decade.
And you just kind of see, you can, especially when you're external. No, don't mind you, I haven't perfected this, but I think I've gotten better at closing those. I'm like, what's the information I have today? Act, decision, repeat, repeat, repeat all the way through. And the person who's still collecting information, as you would tell in that scenario, they'll be in that information collecting stage, which is safe. I get it. It's safe. There's no risk. All you're doing is collecting information. There, nothing can go wrong when you're just learning more things. And that's incorrect, because the thing that's going wrong is you're not moving forward. You are inherently being stagnant.
I'm glad you said that, because when I first started thinking about this entrepreneurial stuff, I was reading books, I was listening to podcasts, and that's essentially what I was doing for years, is collecting information. And I think in some ways that slowed me down, where I was listening to so many different things and hearing so many different perspectives. And well, this person said you should do it this way, and that person said you should do it this way. So which thing should I really do? And I ended up not doing anything at all. And that's specific to the entrepreneurial side of things, where that's why I'm still talking about it now. But I've noticed that since I've started saying, hey, this needs to be a real thing, I'm now 35. And at some point, there's going to be a family and whatever else. And I'm not going to be able to take some of the chances that I would be able to take today. I need to really start moving toward this goal. And I think what was helpful for me was breaking it down into sizable chunks. So step one, clearing all debt. Step two, finding ways to save more money. Step three, making more money. And those latter two can happen in parallel. But once I broke it down into manageable chunks, and this has been the case with all the goals I think that I've accomplished over the course of my life, is that when I've broken it down into manageable chunks, I won't say that it was just flat out easy, but it's made it easier overall.
Appreciate you saying that, because it gives me two things to build on. Number one, and along those lines of someone, because they're probably stuck in this pattern. Honestly, I would say that if it was an 80-20, this would be the 80% of people. They actually fall in the group of either they don't act or decide, or they stay in that area too long. That's another way of looking at it, because that's the outcome is the same, whether you act or decide, or you remain there for months versus a decision you could have made in that first day. We talked about this actually several years ago now, is I think my aha moment was competitive goals versus complementary goals. And when I started to focus more on goals, like you said, it would build off one another. So if I pay off debt, that builds towards this, that helps towards this. Whereas before I was like, I want to pay off debt and I want to start a business and I want to do this. And I had all these goals that didn't build from one another. So they acted in conflict. Like literally each hour would have to be allocated to one or the other, versus like, if I finish this, now I'm 10% through this next step. It already pushes me forward. And if I finish these two, now I'm 50% towards starting the business and things like that. And to your point, I don't even know if it's age or maturity, or maybe it's both, is I've also come to appreciate like my list of things I want to do. There's probably 10 to 25. Like I think I got 21 note list in my iPhone right now. But from week to week, I try to keep it to 2 to 3 things. Every weekend, I have this little short list, and it's literally called action items. And I think this weekend it has 10. But every weekend, I try to knock out the top 3. So I organize it by priority. I was actually talking to a mentee about that, because it's not the goal of completing all 10. It's the goal of knocking things off the list. So I'll be whatever amount of steps right. I complete further in the year than the person who's just staring at the list, assuming they even have a list to stare at. That's number one. And then as far as the aspect of either financial independence, financial freedom, or the ultimate, you know, existential question, does money buy happiness? You know, something I realized recently, I really don't think money ever bought happiness. I used to think, and that was like one of my main pursuits for it. But what it does do, that does make me happy, is it bought me time. So when I was broke, and working three jobs, I never even had time to think in the abstract and to think about this list. Like, I would have never been able to have this conversation 10 years ago because I was working three jobs. I'm running around trying to pay bills. I'm overwhelmed by debt. I didn't have time to be not only proactive, but more so to be mentally active about where my life was going. My entire life on the 24 hours other than when I was sleeping was reactive. Everything was reactive. And so as I knocked these things off the list that I no longer have to worry about, I can just sit around and reflect. I can, you know, beard stroke, as they say, because I have the time and luxury to do it. And that's why I'm saying that's probably why it's so abstract to people. Like, I'm listening to this podcast while I'm going to work. These earbuds are in my ear right now while I'm at this job. I'm working these three jobs or whatever the case may be. There's another side to that story on the other side of that fence, and the grass is truly greener.
Yeah, it's definitely a process, I think is the best way to explain it. And no matter what people do to try to be perfect, you're going to find yourself going in loops. You're going to find yourself going in squiggly lines, and it's going to take some trial and error to ultimately get to where it is that you want to go. And I think a lot of people see that professionally as well, where you get people coming out of school. And I think I was like this, where I came out of school and I'm like, I know what my dream job is. And then people get into that dream job and it turns into a nightmare. You know, I'm looking at this now, even where I've been since 2013. In that time, my total compensation since 2013, before adjusting for the Bay Area struggle living, it's nearly quadrupled. And that's a result of decisions that I've been making over the course of years. So, for example, even something like knowing the value of transferable skills and what the next role is going to be. You know, so I knew when I was working at a staffing agency, and even how I got into working at a staffing agency, I had to say, what are my transferable skills from this sales job? What's the next closest thing that's going to get me into HR? Since I can't get HR jobs right away because I have no HR experience, and of course, they always want experience. And I said, you know what? I can transfer these skills to a staffing agency where I'm doing recruiting, which is an HR function, which is going to count toward credit for my professional and human resources certification. And that's going to put me in a position to make that leap into an HR role. So I went and worked at a staffing agency for like 2.5 years. And of course, at the time that I went to work at that agency, the recession started. So as far as the commissions and the big checks, nah, bruh. It was not the best experience. But from a professional perspective, it positioned me to make that leap. And so from there, I moved from Boston to New York City, where I worked at a nonprofit. And so if you've worked at a nonprofit, you know that typically high salary increases isn't a thing. You actually end up probably taking a bit less than you, oftentimes a lot less than what you would get at a publicly traded or a private company. But it was an opportunity to move into the exact position that I thought that I wanted as an HR generalist. And so I get there and I do that for about 3.5 years. And ultimately, by the end of it, I was like, this job is not for me. I'm not going to front. Like, I crushed it all throughout that job. There were some things I did well. There were some things that I really enjoyed. And when I think about what I really enjoyed, it was more so the recruiting side of things above and beyond anything else. Any thoughts there, good brother?
Well, I was less purposeful than that. But I think for many years, my main motivation, like I said, was the pursuit of, as you phrased it, compensation. But really, it was just money. I was like, where is there more money at? And honestly, for that, that's why I tell people, some people are like, hey, pursue your dreams and the money will follow. And I'm like, no, not necessarily. Like, if you want to make money, divorce yourself from, you know, how you feel about it and what others will say. Chase money. Go after it. Go after it. Because, you know, I personally know how that story ends. It didn't fulfill that happiness that I thought it would. But I will say that as far as the pursuit, it worked. Like, chasing money led to more money that I think would not have happened had I not been so proactive about going after it. So I think people sometimes they struggle with that. Well, yeah, I'm not supposed to like money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, society says, and it doesn't buy happiness. And like, if you think, and I hope you prove me wrong and maybe you have a different journey. But if that motivates you, I would say you don't need other people's approval to pursue the things that motivate you. I'd say somewhere along that journey.
I agree.
And it was weird when it happened. I'd say it was around 27 because I remember having this conversation with was then a mentor at the time. I became disenfranchised because, like you said, I was making more money than ever. Actually, at one point, I think I got a 40% raise, coincidentally, between a job that I pursued and then a promotional opportunity came available. And I say coincidentally because I don't know if it was luck or opportunity and preparation colliding, but this position came available and, you know, I applied for it. I got it ultimately. So a lot of things worked out, but I think they worked out because I prepared myself to succeed when that opportunity presented itself.
So what do you think made you ready?
Well, for me, and I talked a little bit about this in that Yahoo Finance article, and I'm going to talk a little bit, I'll get that in the show notes, but I'll talk a little bit about what wasn't covered in that and was the luck aspect and the move. And so I was willing to move. And for me, fortunately, I had a network of people who were advocating for me who said, here are the certifications you need. So I obtained three during the course of my career. I still have these three. And so I found out afterwards that when I got hired by my then boss, he said, that's what made you stood out. I was really admirable. It was really admirable. Your resume stood out because you had these certifications, which honestly, I didn't think anything of. I got those certifications because several years before that, another manager was like, yeah, get these certifications. He like kind of said it dismissively. He's like, yeah, get these certifications. You could be an auditor for the rest of your life. I was like, and I'm just so action oriented. I was like, cool. That makes sense to me. I'm gonna go study for these tests. I got it done. And it didn't pay off immediately. I had these certifications for about a year. It's not like I got the certification and then I got the promotion like the next day. And so, but it was more like something to do. Does that make sense? It wasn't, I didn't have any plan for what I was going to do with these things. And yet they opened these doors for this opportunity when it came available.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I knew that the professional and human resources certification, even though I hadn't been working in a formal HR role, I knew at least having that certification would signal to potential employers that, hey, this person is serious about this career path. And I'm glad you mentioned the network piece, because that job where I ended up working at the nonprofit, that's the one job that I've gotten that was due to a referral, where it was somebody that I went to school with. I had talked to them about their role there and what they did. I told them I was looking to make a move. And then when a position became available, they thought of me. And I went and ultimately interviewed for the position. It was nothing that was guaranteed. It wasn't like, oh, this person referred me. That carries all the weight in the world. I still had to go in and meet with five or six people. I had to talk to the CEO of the organization even as a last step of the process. But tying that to the good career decisions and solid career schools, when it comes to preparing for a phone interview, we've talked about treating it as an open book test. And so when I had a phone interview, I had one screen that had my resume on it. I had another screen, or maybe it was a notepad at that time. I wasn't sure if I was living that two screen life, where I had different mental triggers based on what the question was that would allow me to tell a different story. And so that allows me to get to the on-site interview where I got to make the trip to New York City. And I would note that since 2007, there has not been an on-site interview that I've went on where I have not gotten the job. And a lot of that comes down to preparation. And once you do that preparation, it also builds confidence. So I know even now that when I'm going in for an interview, and this is even how I've thought about it over the years, that when I'm going in for an interview, even a phone interview, all I know is that if I can just get in the door and get on site, there is a very high chance that I'm going to get this job because I've done the preparation that's boosted my confidence. I've done the research. And I know that I'm gonna leave it all out there. I mean, I made that sound like a basketball game, like we was playing for the chip. But I mean, that's kind of like what it was, you know. So that preparation and that thoughtfulness about the next step in your career, that helps build confidence in itself because you're moving with purpose. Going back to what you said earlier.
So the article that I alluded to is the four steps I took to raise my salary 400% or something to the effect. The Google search will get you there. Some of you have already seen it. So it's on in my Instagram at the Marcus Garrett, and I'll get that in the show notes. But there's actually three. I actually went, and when we did the interview, this is the beautiful magic of editing. I actually covered 7. And there's a few that, you know, it's their discretion. I'm happy to leave the interview out there. I actually wish they had covered, because I think they're really important aspects. The other three was to choose the right career. I talk a little bit about this all the time, so it doesn't really matter. But find a mentor and build your network, and then take calculated risk, which is to your last point there. But what I really want to focus on is choosing the right career. I didn't choose my career, so to speak. My career kind of landed on me much like Plymouth Rock. Like, I didn't go out. No, I haven't ran into an auditor that has ever said, like, you know, when I was a small child and they asked me at career services day what I wanted to do. Everyone was saying astronaut, fireman, and I said auditor. Like, no, that story is, I haven't heard it yet. Maybe there's an auditor out there who
knew. I don't think anyone probably said that about that profession.
Exactly. So I'm very fortunate and lucky that I got into a career, but the advice that I offer now is to be more purposeful in the career you choose, because I see people, and like I said, I became disenfranchised at about 27 I had everything that I thought I wanted on my checklist. Like, if I had gone back to that checklist I probably wrote at that time, maybe 23, 25, I could have checked off all the boxes, yet the happiness that I thought would come from that did not align. I did not have the 100% happiness that should align with all the boxes that I had checked off. That's twofold, because I didn't choose a career. I went after the money, and the money didn't make me happy. And then number two, I see people who go into careers where they become upset with either the outcome of the career, the job function of the career, and most often the salary or pay of the career. And I'm like, you know, I can look online and see that salary was going to max out at $30,000. And then they're shocked and appalled, and they're like, man, I haven't gotten a raise in 10 years, and I still make what I made at, I'm 40 years old, and I make what I made at 20. And I was like, I could have told you that 20 years ago. I'm sorry, but like, this is, especially now, there's less of an excuse. This is readily, easily, Googleably, searchably information, and there's more and more resources each day for how accurate it is. I knew how much money in my last job, because I work in the public sector, and most people know this. You can go online, all public, well, 90% of public sector jobs, the information is available online because it's public sector. You're entitled to it because that's what your taxes get you. I knew how much money I was going to make down to the pay raises at 23. I calculated the next 32 years. I took out an Excel spreadsheet and I said, okay, if I averaged 3% cost of living rate, I knew how much I was going to make over the next 32 years. And it was actually surprisingly low. I was like, huh, all right. And then what I think people don't do is, again, going back to that active decision, you know, it's like that scenario, like, would you want to know the exact day that you die? I know the exact day that my salary is going to die. And now it was up to me to figure out what I was going to do differently. And I think by that time, I think I was still writing at that time, but you and I were working together. I was like, I knew then that I needed to look into either working for myself, working in multiple income streams, paying down my debt, which I was already working towards at that time anyway. So excuse me, this was 27 when I started making these types of decisions. But I just don't think people are, like you said, are purposeful about that and take the onus on themselves. Like, okay, this is my future. I literally had like a crystal ball, and this is my salary related future. And it didn't look like a future I wanted to have. And it fell back on me to make a difference there. I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, my job should promote me and they should pay me more, or I should get paid for my dreams. And like, because someone told me, follow your dreams and the money will follow. And I'm like,
nope.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you do have that realization, or you have not yet, I strongly encourage you to go out there if you are concerned and say, okay, what is the median? And it's a Google search. You search Google median salary. And maybe you have some resources you could recommend. We talked about the Occupational Outlook Handbook, which is a federal resource, of course, which is where I would go. Mind you, they have, I don't know, 150 years of data. So it's a pretty good source. And look for your salary title. And it'll tell you three things. It'll tell you the median. It'll tell you the average. It'll tell you the quartiles. And if only 10%, because usually there's somebody even in any field that is making like six figures and they're doing well. But if that quartile is like 3%, yeah, and that salary you want is only 3% of individuals, that probability is not in your favor. So I would start asking yourself, okay, you know, what do I need to do differently here to align my life or lifestyle, income or salary, whatever your goals may be, with what I want from this career, assuming you want that career to go forward.
One of the other things that I noticed with folks who are in that top percentage, top 3% or whatever it is, a lot of times that may require you to move into a role where you got to do things that you don't really want to do, or you got to commit a level of time that you're not prepared to commit.
Management.
So for some roles.
Mint.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, I would say if I wasn't in management, yeah, I'd probably still be doing well, but that's definitely been a significant factor in how my income has increased. And I've seen what a manager's life looks like above me, even multiple levels above me. And I see that that requires a whole different type of sacrifice. But the trade-off is the financial reward. And for some folks, if you're doing something that you really do actually enjoy doing, and you're getting to think critically in a way that you want to be able to think, and I know there are some folks who probably don't want to think much at all, and that's totally fine. I've had my periods of that as well. You need to consider, okay, if I do want to move within that 3% within this particular job, what's going to be expected of me? And if you decide that that's still something that you want to do, then that's where the next level of preparation begins. And I think even for myself, when I got to the point in that HR generalist job where I was like, yo, I hate this, quite honestly. I'm walking down this long hallway and I'm trying to power myself up to be able to smile once I get in the door. I'm doing this job that I'm ultimately not great at. You know, I'd say I was average at it. And a lot of what an HR generalist does, it's a lot of process. It's a lot of attention to detail. It's a lot of working in spreadsheets, dealing with compensation. And as someone that tends to be a more strategic and creative thinker and tends to operate at a high level, it is really hard sometimes for me to sit and figure out like how a number got to what it is from some complex calculation. I remember when we had to implement a new performance management system, which sounds like, you know, you just installed the software and it's up and running. Nah, that's not what it's like. There are phases. There's a lot of project management. There's a lot of granular details that needed to be paid attention to. And I learned the hard way that, one, this is an area for development, but two, this is also not the path that I want to take, and these are not the types of decisions that I want to be making long term.
Yeah, I just quickly, because I had to do a little Google search over here. It's funny you're talking about numbers. Because I also think people are either disconnected or they work in the abstract around what Americans make and what salary distribution is like in this country. And so to give some context to that, from Bankrate, only 20% of households ever break six figures. That's one in five. And at the individual level, it's 7%. So, and I only use six figures because that's just usually easy for people. 100,000, that's usually an easy number for people to work towards. But I just want people to kind of reflect on that a little bit. There's over 300 million people in America. That is a very small percentage of people who get there. And I would argue the majority of those people who do aren't making it from a truly salary-only job. Not that group that's above that threshold, if that is a threshold that you are striking or moving towards. So I just wanted to give some folks some numbers to work with.
And that's why we will talk more about additional income streams, because I think we've, especially if you've been listening to this show or just looking around in general in the personal finance space, you'll find that the real wealth comes from the additional income streams, whether that's investing, whether that's a side hustle, whether that's creating some product or service usually a product that you can sell in your sleep. You're making money while you sleep. So we'll talk more about that. But as far as, you know, being in this job and being at this transition point, I thought again, what are the transferable skills? What is it that I want to do next? And I made a conscious decision. I said, I want to eventually work in a larger company like a Google or like a Facebook. And I know that right now I'm probably not positioned the best for the type of role that I want there. And I even had someone who referred me for a role at Google while I was at the nonprofit, and I didn't even get an interview at the time. And I was like, all right, I've got some work to do. And I realized for me, what would be highly beneficial would be to move to a tech company. And I remember thinking to myself, it's going to be hard for me to get into one of the hot name tech companies where there are people who already have all the qualifications and some. So let me look at some startups that are out there, and let me look at some startups that aren't necessarily as hot, where the work is going to be equally as challenging, and it's going to allow me to pick up the skills that I need to be able to make that leap to a larger company. So I ended up going to a tech startup in New York City, And a big part of being able to make that move, yes, there was the phone interview and the onsite interview, but it was also my LinkedIn profile. And I think I talked early on in this podcast, maybe it was the last podcast that we had together, about how there was a period where I was applying for jobs and my LinkedIn profile didn't match. And so as a recruiter, a lot of times we'll get a resume and then we'll go cross-reference that on LinkedIn. And so if it's an inconsistent story, that raises questions. And I could remember applying for jobs through those black holes, going on LinkedIn, seeing some grayed out silhouette had viewed my profile from the company that I had applied to and never getting a phone call. And what I decided to do was say, this is the next role that I want to pursue. Let me look at some of the other roles that are out there that are very similar. Let me look at the LinkedIn profiles. So I had this thing where I said, use LinkedIn as a career consultant. I mean, it's essentially a research database. You can see people in the role that you want, where they've come from, what skills they've picked up, what they're doing now, and then work on building those skills in your current role. And then also optimizing your LinkedIn profile so that you come up in searches. So one, there's telling the consistent story between your resume and your LinkedIn profile, but there's also optimizing for the role that you want. And so the hiring manager for the position I'd applied for at the startup viewed my LinkedIn profile, and I got a call or an email within a couple of days of that. And then, you know, I went through the interview process and I ultimately landed that role. I know we've talked about folks moving around, and that ended up being the shortest tenure of all the jobs that I've had. I was there for about 9 months. But here's the thing. I had talked about wanting to go work at a large tech company, and I figured it would have to be a situation where I apply and I talk to 1,000 people or maybe a couple who were in good positions. And ultimately, that big tech company found me on LinkedIn. I didn't go find them. They came and found me. And had my LinkedIn profile not been optimized, had I not been thoughtful about the stepping stone job that I was going to take in between to put me in a position to get that job, this may not have happened. I might have ultimately ended up working somewhere and making a bit more money, but I wouldn't have been looking at working at the internet. Y'all can go to my LinkedIn profile and figure out who that is. So I'm still nervous about actually saying where I work, even though it's like very visible. And that doesn't happen if I don't take those thoughtful steps throughout my career and I don't keep my LinkedIn profile optimized for the role that I want, while also thinking about the skills that I'm going to need to be able to get there. So again, went through the interview process, the phone interview prep, and knocking out the phone interview, then flying on site and having to meet with, bro, I think I met with like 12 people total. And it was the one time that I interviewed and I was worried that I wasn't going to get the job because they asked a lot of hypothetical, how would you handle situations, where I think most folks tend to prepare for the tell me about a time when, which I did get some of those as well. But even doing some research on the internet about the types of questions that come up during these interviews, even though I don't think my answers were flawless, I felt better prepared knowing that these painful questions that everyone talks about that trip people up are going to come up. And so I'm going to be prepared when I hear them, even though I have no idea what it is that they're going to ask. And so that interview process wasn't easy. There was a lot of sweating. There was a lot of waiting. It took a while for it to happen. And there was even a period where I didn't hear anything back after, I want to say it was after my second phone interview. And so I figured, up, I know what that means. I didn't get the job. And then one day I said, you know what? Let me follow up. There are so many things that could happen. I'm a recruiter now. I get busy. And I followed up and just said, hey, I'm not sure what happened with that previous opportunity. Just want to let you know I'm still very interested. And then the recruiter replied and said, oh, hey, that position went on hold, but there's another position that's available that you might be a good fit for. What do you think about this? And then that's what really kicked everything into high gear. And after that, you know, I was flying out to California for the on-site interview. And as I said, yeah, it was stressful and everything, but I ultimately ended up getting the job. And working at a larger tech company, there's going to be a lot more in terms of pay and in terms of benefits. And I'll maybe talk more about some of those things in a future episode when we're looking at ways that people can find more money in their paycheck or just in their life in general. But if I don't take those steps, I'm not in the position where I am today. If I don't go and work as an individual contributor and ensure that I'm getting exceeds expectations and then understand what it takes to become a manager and then slowly taking on those responsibilities to position myself for a promotion, talking to my manager and manager's manager about what it takes to get promoted, and then ultimately getting promoted after implementing those steps, none of this probably happens. I'm probably not in a position to get out of all the credit card debt. I'm not in a position to pay my car off 2 years early. And that's the result of good career decisions. Now, there are financial practices too that are really important, but I think this is something that often gets left out of the conversation. So I wanted to make sure folks understood, like, yeah, you know, the getting out of debt habits, all of those other things that we talk about the show are critical, but you also need to make sure you're being as thoughtful about what it is you do by day and what it is you're going to be doing over the next however many years of your life and how you're going to get from step to step to be able to achieve the financial goals that you want outside of your job.
Another thing, and we're both beneficiaries, I guess, from this, and I think people are hesitant to do, so they, and I guess in this scenario, they want to eat their cake and there is no cake to even have it too. And that is like, so I'll keep this anonymous, but I was talking to an individual. I've gotten really bigger on mentoring now because I'm, you know, trying to give back to the kids, you know, like, so I've transitioned into that phase of my life. And so I've taken on a number of mentoring projects lately. And I'm talking to this individual, and I think a lot of times I also try to be empathetic to the fact that this is their first time. So I like to let them work through it. I don't want to cut them off. So he's going through all these scenarios. He's talking about where he lives and all the limited opportunities. And he's got this college degree and he's got all his certifications. He's done everything right. He's done all the things they talk about in the books. I'm just like, frankly, he's rambling. So I'm letting him walk through the motions. He's going through the five stages. He's working his way towards acceptance. And I knew the answer when he started, but I needed him to get there. And when he, you know, after explaining all this limited non-availability of opportunities where he lives, because actually it went off to school and went back home, it was glaring. Like it was almost like you'd had to put your shades on. It was so blinding because we both came to the same realization, or he did at the end, that I had in the beginning. And it was move. Mm. Like, you sometimes need to leave. And I know people hate to hear that. Companies should come to them. Opportunities should be made available. But that's not how this life game works. And
that's such a good point.
I've moved. I've actually lost track. I've moved two times. Well, I guess two out of state, then back into state as far as where I live. But as far as four jobs, I've moved like six to eight times. I don't even know how many times I've moved for various jobs. Because for me, the opportunity, the outcome is more important than the being tied down. Now, as you know, and a number of people who listen to the show both on and offline know, I'm trying to become, I guess, work independent, or what is it? Cord independent, so that I could work anywhere. Like ideally, I would have a client base that it
doesn't. Location independent.
Yeah. Yeah. So geography doesn't matter. So maybe you can have a job like that, whether it's telework or you're working from home or you have your own business. But if that's not the case, I just see sometimes people stagnate for no fault of their own other than literally where they live or are regionally located does not have opportunity. And it doesn't matter how smart and degrees and things that you may have, if you don't become location independent, your area is going to limit your growth. And some people hear that and they're like, I kind of phrase it like there's, you know, good excuses, bad excuses, and everything in between, but they're all excuses. So I know people are already thinking of all these great excuses, which is usually people's first go-to. They're great coming up with excuses about why it won't work. Even if they don't try it, they can tell you why it won't work.
Yeah.
But in this particular scenario, I'm not saying permanently. You don't have to live and die in LA. Like, yo, like, just go there temporarily. Because also, I am living proof. When I went to Denver, I took that opportunity, as I said, I think it's like a 40% pay increase at that time. Then I got I think it was a 10 to 13% pay increase on that because I got promoted to a supervisor position. That then became my new negotiating salary. Never, and for the rest of my life, go beyond that salary unless I'm taking what I would call a scalable risk to take on my own business. But every time I negotiate, people say, if they say, what's your bottom base salary? I'm like, I can't go backwards in lifestyle. Shout out to Chris Rock to this one. Like, it is here. Like, and I make more than that now, but I was like, I remember what that was like. I remember that threshold. I could live on that. I could step shape that. I don't want to. Why would I want to go backwards? But if they ever ask, like, what is the minimal? Like, it's this. It is a very clear and defined number, and I can adjust it accordingly. People don't have that negotiating strength because they're coming from an area where they're either at the bottom or at best at the middle. So they don't have that negotiating salary strength to get sometimes the salary they quite frankly do deserve, but they don't have the negotiating strength to ask for it. Because I'm like, well, I'm giving you a $20,000 raise here. And they're like, but I know everybody else makes $40,000 of that. And I'm like, well, you ain't everybody else. It's like, I don't know what to tell you. I wouldn't even be able to justify paying you $40,000 more. Like, financial would jump down my throat if I tried to do that. Like, now I can give you this 20 and then you can go back and negotiate that 20 when you go back to the either your job you're at or when you move back. But you strengthen, you want to always operate from a position of strength. And I think that's what this discussion entails. And I kind of, when I did put this checklist together, I called that a calculated risk. It is a chance, but it's calculated. It's just not all risk. You're taking a chance on yourself. And then again, I want to hit, because for me, it's both been invaluable personally. I can't put a numeric value to it, but I know for a fact these individuals have advocated for me. I actually did talk to one that was my reference, still is. They said it would be a grave mistake not to bring you on. Like, she was like one of the final deciding factors. And because she was very high in the organization, very well respected. And they're like, if somebody would advocate for you that high up that we need to hire for you, we knew it'd be a mistake not to. And so you need those mentors, those coaches, those sponsors. And like the difference being the sponsor is the person who can make that change for you. I think a lot of people, either formally or informally, they have a mentor. They have someone in their life that they look up to or is pushing for them in the corner. But if that person isn't in a 500 organization, or they're not in the C-suite, or they're not in the corner office, they can't get you the job. They can't pick up the phone and make the call and say, hire that guy or woman, excuse me. You need other people in that network that can do that for you.
Definitely. And even the part about being willing to move locations. So I went from school in Ithaca to living in Boston, then move for a job in New York City, then move to the Bay Area, which is something I said I would never do unless I got a job at this particular company. And that's what ended up happening. So it kind of held my feet to the fire where I was like, well, this is what I said I wanted. So I guess I got to make this move. And the one caveat I'd have, and then we could wrap up, is if you're thinking about making a career change, there may be situations where the only way that you can make that career change is to come in at the entry level in whatever that new role is. And in situations like that, you may find the income increase being minimal. I still think it's important to go with the number of mind, have that target number in mind and still aim high. But know that sometimes when you're doing a career change, it's a bit of a reset. So just having that in mind as well. And if you do research and find out that that is going to be the case for the industry that you want to move into, then you really need to think about that number and what you can do to position yourself to be able to take on that role for the greater long-term success. So, and we've talked a lot about these various career decisions, all of the different things to consider. And we're going to talk a lot more about that stuff on the podcast going forward. Part of why we call the show Paychecks and Balances, the paychecks is actually the work part of it. And we think that there's a lot that folks can do to better position themselves financially by better positioning themselves professionally.
I know we're wrapping here, but I also, because for most people, about 80-90%, I think only 15% of people are entrepreneurs. This is where it's going to be where the main salary comes from. It doesn't have to be the only, and as you say, we'll expand on the multiple income streams and finding your other avenues for bringing in income. But for most people, this is going to be it. That's why we're kind of harping on this so much. And I just want to maybe wrap with the move, because I know that holds up so many people. It's scary, it's daunting, and all these things. And first of all, I would say it's really not, especially now, because everyone's so interconnected. Like, yeah. Like when I moved, it really wasn't like I moved, because I just interacted with the exact same people I did on Facebook. The only difference was I missed a few barbecues and I had to plan a little bit more lead time for vacations and trips in the grand scheme of things, aside from the emotional aspect. But what I would tell people, and I did this, and I've joked about this before, one day I might ask, but I don't know if I ever want to know the answer. When I went for the job where I moved to Denver, I had the list of, and I would tell people to write this down. So come up with all of your excuses, whatever they may be, valid or otherwise, write them all down. And then because, especially if you're already employed, look at what it would take to remove all those excuses. So for me, I was like, I want this salary, which I thought was ridiculous. I want this to happen. I want this to happen. And I mean, it wasn't a particularly long list because I would have gone to Denver anyway. It's actually a great city. Shout out to Denver. But As I talked about on the show, and I'll plug in the show notes, I used a cost of living calculator. I figured out everything that I would need to get the job, and I had nothing to lose. I'm like, if they offer me this job, cool. If not, I'll just go back to work that I'm already at on Tuesday, except I'll just go back Wednesday. And so after I had the interview, or before I had the interview, I jotted down all these things that I would need to be satisfied. And as I walked through, I was checking them off, and the salary was like the last thing. They actually surprised me about it. They were like, how much would you need for us to bring you in? Which I turned out to be a really good sign. I didn't even piece it together at the time. And so I said this number. I just told them, I'm like, yeah, I want this. They're like, cool. And I was like, wait a minute. And to this day, I will forever wonder what I could have asked for. I tell people, like, you know, if it's that's a way to both calm yourself and all those risks that you think you have, just, you know, make the list as outlandish as you need it to be. Like you said, with the Bay Area move. And then make the job satisfy those things. Because if they say no, all you do is go back to the job you already have. And if they say yes, now you have no excuses.
Yeah, so I definitely agree on that. And so we really hope that y'all got a lot out of this episode today. And if you have been enjoying the show, be sure to share with your network and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts. And today's review of the week comes from Nadim. Is that what we settled on?
Yeah. Apologies, Nadim, if we've got that incorrect. Nadim Q, unless the Q is silent. Relatable and straightforward, except for the mispronunciation, possibly, of the name. 5 stars. Nothing beats a message that is easy to implement immediately and spoken in terms of which you can relate to and recognize in your own life and career. Only regret is that I didn't discover this podcast earlier. Keep up the great work! Exclamation mark. Update. Continue to find great benefit from these topics, and not just from the everyday budgeting and saving tips. Recently just took your advice while negotiating compensation at work for a promotion and could not be happier with the results. Again, thank you! Exclamation mark.
That's like the perfect review for this episode.
It really was. You can go to iTunes and they're going to probably think, they're like, man, they photoshopped that. But yes, this is a very real comment. Thank you for the 5 stars, Nadim. And if you'd like to find us on social, we're on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett with 1 T on Twitter, 2 T's everywhere else on earth. And Rich is available at I Am Rich Jones.
I am.
And don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email, where you'll receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more.
Yes, and one more reminder to help my panel get selected for South by Southwest by visiting pickthispanel.com and voting for us, Leveraging Podcast for Career Success, which is also quite fitting for this episode. So again, pickthispanel.com. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, after Labor Day week, be safe. We out. Peace.